time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Emmy Award-winning producer Christopher Koch, who is the was the primary producer for Avoiding Armageddon, the recent PBS series that we had spoke of a couple weeks ago. And we'll be talking about more about that series here. Christopher, thank you for coming in this morning.
Mike, thanks very much for being here.
All right. So we had to actually talk to a local activist who had been observing the series Avoiding Armageddon, as well as you had spoken on Counterspin, I believe, later in that day. So our listeners are a little bit aware of the series and the events surrounding that, but I'm wondering if you can start and tell us, how did you get involved with the series in the first place?
Well, Ted Turner had the vision, and this is prior, a good year prior to 9/11, to really think that the American people and the world in general were not really considering the massive dangers represented by weapons of mass destruction, particularly the fear that because many of them were so loosely controlled that they could fall into the hands of terrorists. And so he proposed this series and decided that it should be a PBS series and went to work on it. And I got involved because Joel Westbrook, who was the first executive producer, called me and asked me if I wanted to work on it.
And you'd had a rich history of working on a lot of different projects, so...
I felt the project was ideally suited for me because I had spent really most of my broadcast career, or much of my broadcast career, dealing with issues of peace and justice and social issues. So this was the big one, and the notion of having 8 hours of primetime PBS airtime to talk about these issues was simply too tempting to give up. Now, what happened was that 9/11 came along, and everything changed. Prior to 9/11, Ted had told us, your primary message here is to alert the American people to the possible danger of a nuclear attack, or some kind of a weapons of mass destruction, rather. Let me correct that. And as soon as 9/11 happened, of course, everybody knew that. So the basic mandate for the show had been accomplished, and we could remind people of that in 5 seconds at the top of the first hour. So then the question was, what do we do with the other 7 hours and 58 minutes? And at that point, we really struggled with the issue of whether or not to go into a journalistic mode and to look into these stories a little more deeply in the field.
All right. And what was your working relationship? You'd worked on this for about 2 years prior to this last spring.
About a year. The whole term was about 2 years.
Okay. What was your working relationship with Turner Documentaries, is that right? And WETA, which is the producing station over in the East Coast, I believe.
Well, once we, the struggle over whether or not to do journalism was really a struggle with Joel Westbrook, and who did not want to do journalism. In fact, he said, we will not commit journalism. And in the end, that was perceived to be a mistake, and he was removed, and I was asked to take over the whole unit, which I did. We began sending people out into the field, and we began getting reports back, and we began working on the series, and we decided that, Turner decided that we wanted to have a member station present the series to the network as a whole, and we picked WETA in Washington. It seemed a natural choice. They were the local station there, and they made a very good pitch for being able to promote this in the entire system. With Ted, I had three meetings with Ted over the course of the project, and then the first one is when he talked about the need to alert the American people to the possibility of a weapons of mass destruction attack of some kind. And he said at that point, I only have two things to direct you. Keep it international, 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 and don't dumb it down. Other than that, he was, I think, unfortunately, not terribly involved with... He did see cuts as they went along. He said that he liked them. I interviewed him several weeks before I was let go, and he had seen then about 4 hours of material and said he was very pleased with what he saw, but he never really got specifically involved in any kind of in more than just kind of a casual way.
So did you feel then for the first couple of years, though, that you were being supported in the direction you were taking things?
Oh, we were, yes, we we had regular editorial meetings with the people in Turner Pictures and with other people they would bring in as consultants. And although they were frequently very, they were certainly arguments and there were just differences and disagreements, but in general it was a very creative process in which we ended with a consensus that we were moving forward in the right direction. I think it was really much later in the process as we got closer to air and as the country moved closer to war in Iraq that the political climate in Washington began to shift markedly. And Washington, of course, and everybody in Washington is a very political town. If you want to survive in Washington, you have to be near the center, part of the consensus. If you step aside from the consensus, then you really become a pariah. You lose all influence and power. So I think as we move closer to air and as the country moved closer to war and as questioning government policies became more questionable, WEDA and PBS became nervous about a too liberal slant on a show done by somebody who is known to be a provocative thinker and talker, Ted Turner. I was told at times, you know, don't make this another Bill Moyers. We don't want another Bill Moyers. You've got to stay in the middle here.
So at some point then, did they ask you to start making changes and or corrections?
No, the strange thing was that we never got a request to make a specific change that we refused to make. We would win in these lengthy editorial meetings, which would sometimes go on for 4 or 5 hours. We would win, that is me and my team, we would win every argument, and we would convince people that the way we were doing this was the way to do it in the correct way. But you could see that although we had persuaded them intellectually, they still resisted. And I'm sure they left and said, gosh darn it, I really know that's just not right. I think I've found in my career that frequently when people are concerned about something you've done on radio or television, but they can't articulate exactly what it is, it's that their view of the world has been challenged. They're being asked by it to see things differently. And I think that's what broadcasting and art ought to do, which is to make people see things differently. That's why I think why audiences come back to stuff. That's what engages people and makes them interesting. That's part of the entertainment value, if you will, of what we do, is engaging their mind and making them see things differently. But middle managers tend to get very worried when they're asked to see things differently, particularly in a town like Washington, which is so consensus-driven.
So at some point in time back here in January, then did they just send you a note or leave a message on your voicemail or what?
Almost. It was a very strange experience because, I had had a flurry. I was, you know, you're in charge of a unit. You've got 8 hours. You're getting 125, 150 emails a day. The phone never stops ringing. We had sent out some material to be reviewed by PBS. Kobe Atlas of PBS reviewed it and gave us some rather tough notes. They really weren't unusually... They were the kind of notes you get in a rough cut. Maybe there was a little more an attitude, but they were basically good notes. And I responded and said, well, yeah, with a lot of these things we have fixed, other things we are fixing, we're bringing in a writer, we're doing this. And I thought everything was proceeding just fine. And I came in... That was on a Saturday. I came in the Monday, and there were no emails. And there were no phone calls. And instantly something has happened. And I had an editorial meeting. I was working with the staff. And then I was called upstairs to my office by the Turner Pictures people and said, you're out. Four of your producers are out. Your senior producer is out. I want you out of the building. In half an hour, we're having a meeting to announce the new team. And that was it.
So where did you take it from there? Or was it?
Well, we were stunned. I mean, I was stunned. I said, I don't understand what this is about. What is the problem here? And so we were just kind of in shock mode. We were 6 weeks away from delivery. The deadline for delivery was later extended. The new team got an additional 11 weeks of production time and additional money to work further. But we were 6 or 12, whatever it was, weeks away from delivery, whether we got extensions or not. And it seemed to us to make so little sense to pull a whole creative team out of a project at that point and bring in a new team. Even if the team had been terrifically good, we did over 250 interviews. I mean, I'd read every one of those interviews. We had picked sound bites. You can't read 250 interviews in 11 weeks and work them into a show. So even just practically speaking, it seemed like a very unusual and foolish thing to do. And we, of course, called them and said, listen, we think you're making a big mistake. Don't do this. But they were persuaded to go ahead, and that did no good whatsoever. In fact, subsequent to that then, a number of other staff members drifted away. Either they were let go or they quit. So they basically went into the final 11 weeks of production with almost a brand new team.
Now, you've been in the industry producing news for 40 years. Have you ever experienced anything like this before? And do you think the climate now is shifted so much that it essentially allowed this to happen?
I'd never seen anything like this before in my life. I was really stunned. I think we all were. I mean, I wouldn't have been surprised if it had happened 6 months earlier with 6 months left in the production cycle. I mean, that would have made some kind of sense, I think. I mean, if you know, at least it would have been a practical thing to have done because a new team could come in and have the time to go through the material and really make changes and go out and do some additional shooting. What normally would have happened if they were unhappy with the editorial direction of the show is they would have brought in somebody either over me or parallel to me to kind of take that over and say, okay, Chris, but they would have kept my team there. They just would have forced us to do it in their way. And I don't know what I would have done. I mean, I think I would have continued to argue, but I think in the end, if they had said this is the way it has to be, I probably would have, as a professional craftsman, you know, have done that. I mean, they're the client. It's a work for hire. But I never got that opportunity.
All right. So tell us, after now having seen the series air, what did they change?
Well, it was very, very strange, Mike, because when we looked at the shows, it was like seeing an old friend who had gone away for a frontal lobotomy. He looked the same, wore the same clothes, but there's just the inside was missing. It was just gone. In many cases, the words had not been changed from the words that we had written, but but certain parts were changed. So you saw a familiarity. I mean, they were the same pieces. They had dropped some pieces, but a lot of them were. They didn't do any new work, is what I guess I'm saying. There weren't a lot of new interviews. There weren't a lot of new productions. So they worked with what we had given them. So it was familiar, and yet what was missing from it, I felt. What we spent a lot of time, we knew this was very tough stuff for people to watch and very difficult stuff for people to think about. And we felt that both to keep an audience and to be responsible, we needed to give people hope that there was something they could do about these issues. So we stressed throughout the series and the show citizen participation but of course most citizen participation in these, it's a protest. And a lot of that was removed. The peace movement, there was lots of sections on the peace movement of the 50s, you know, the anti-nuclear movement. That was gone. There was a large... Now, I have to be careful because in many instances, it wasn't that it was completely gone. It was that it was diminished so much in size and length that it ceased to have the impact that it had before. So it might have been mentioned, but it wasn't experienced by the viewer.
And the peace movement of the 50s and then later in the 70s being so key to shaping a lot of the policies that the current administration is now tearing up as treaties.
That's right. That's right. We had a wonderful story in Anniston, Alabama that was actually was used in the promotion to promote the series. A group of citizens who were concerned about plans on the part of the Army to incinerate chemical weapons left over from World War II, which are now beginning to leak and pose a danger, and they certainly have to be gotten rid of. The plan has been to burn them. The people of Anniston are concerned that there'll be some mistakes, and these plants apparently burp occasionally, and these awful deadly chemicals come out into the community. And really, they had not been assured by the government that they were going to be safe. They'd been given what we were all given, duct tape and plastic to put over their windows in the event of an accident. And there's a very strong protest movement in Anniston to oppose that. They have an alternative way they'd like to see it disposed of called neutralization, which is a new technology. Anyway, there was a long discussion of that, and we heard from the citizens, and we heard from their involvement. And again, it wasn't just, I think, not the fact that they were protesting, but the fact that you see people who are getting involved and engaged and who are actually making changes in their community. That we thought would inspire other people to do likewise. Well, and that was cut down to one quote from one protester. So it was there, yes, but it had no impact on anybody.
I believe another example of people protesting and changing policy significantly had happened after the First World War, relating to chemical weapons.
Well, we felt one of the important lessons of history. We looked at history, trying to draw lessons for it from today, and it is arguable. And we had both sides of these issues internally. None of these were presented in a one-sided way. I want to make that perfectly clear. But there is a lot of. I mean, there was an outcry of horror on the use of chemical weapons in World War I. The world was really horrified by that. And although treaties were passed to ban it, of course there were loopholes in them, and governments continued to produce these things. And there were many of them available. In fact, taken to the battlefields of World War II, but they were never used. Now, there's a lot of reasons why they weren't used. They weren't used because military commanders didn't think they were really great weapons in some ways. They were tricky to use. They could drift in the wind. But certainly one of the important factors was that the moral revulsion against their use was so strong that no nation really, well, Italy used them against the Ethiopians. But with that exception, no nation used them on the battlefields of Europe. By contrast, later when Saddam Hussein began the war with Iran, he introduced the use of chemical weapons slowly, beginning with tear gas, looked for the reaction of the world. Nobody said anything. And then he used more chemicals. And because the West was so upset with Iran at the time and viewed Iran as our enemy, the enemy of our et cetera, nobody really said a thing. And then, of course, he finally used them on his own people, the Kurds in northern Iraq. And finally, the world began to pick up and pay attention. But we have several people in think tanks, and it's credible that if the world had rose in revulsion against Saddam Hussein's first use of chemical weapons, that they certainly wouldn't have been used against the Kurds. That they might, maybe he would have done it in the Iran war because he was so desperate, but that it's unlikely that he would have taken that approbation from the world for using against the Kurds. So the point was, at least, that it's arguable that when the public keeps its attention on these issues and holds politicians feet to the fire, that they can make change.
Now, is the issue with Saddam's weapons, was that something you had covered in the series at all?
Once we went into journalism, of course, we were faced with very, very difficult choices. I mean, we're recording interviews and interviewing people and putting them together in the summer and fall, and we're wondering if we're going to go to war in Iraq. We don't know. And we don't know whether the war in Iraq will take place prior to our broadcast date or whether it will take place during a broadcast. So how do we prepare for that? Well, I brought in a separate unit, a journalism unit, just to track the Iraq. And also, we're also looking at North Korea at the same time because that was a similar crisis going on. But to track those current, and we had planned to bring in current data to keep current on that. But that was there were some very difficult choices to be made around that. It was a funny time to put this series on the air. I mean, the timing was great in the sense that people were interested, but it was such a volatile time, it was hard to figure out what to do well in advance of it.
So it also seems kind of ironic that if we're looking at just this week, for instance, the Senate Armed Services Subcommittee voted, I think, yesterday to back the production again of low-yield nuclear weapons.
Yes, we had made a big deal in the series, and I don't remember well enough how this turned out in the final version, but we had made a big deal in our when we were working in the series of the current administration's attempts to kind of begin working on a new generation of nuclear weapons. Obviously, this is something that really is of great concern in the international community because it seems to many people in India and Pakistan and elsewhere to be sending the wrong message. If we think these weapons have utility, then why shouldn't other people have them? I mean, that's what you're going to say if you're in another country. You know, if the United States military thinks that they need nukes, well, goodness, don't we? It's an ironic in a way that when we looked at Iraq and we looked at their weapons of mass destruction programs, one of the reasons driving it was that it was cheaper for them to produce weapons of mass destruction than it was to buy Kalashnikov rifles from the Soviet Union. So in a certain way, these weapons of mass destruction become attractive to poorer countries.
And of course, now we're seeing that, you know, North Korea, Iran, the list goes on for potential targets.
Yes. Yeah.
So, again, getting back to the series and your many years of journalism, did you have a sense this was, when you got started on this project, did you have a sense that potentially the outcome of your removal could occur?
I never expected us all to be removed. I did. I knew. I knew throughout the editorial process that there was going to be intense discussion over the editorial direction the show was taking, and that we were going to have to deal with that. But as I say, we were never actually told to do something we didn't do. So I don't know how we would have in the end if we'd been said to do. It's a very kind of strange situation in a way, because although it's news and information, it's also a creative process. And as I think we all know, it's very difficult for committees to make anything good in a creative area. I mean, it really takes an individual or a small team with a vision to come up with something. And I think that, at several editorial meetings, I would turn to Robert Westman, I would say, well, I've got four different pieces of advice here, Robert, on this particular. Which one do you want me to follow? Do you want me to follow this person's or this person's or this person's? You know, even the editorial criticism of the series was not consistent. There was not like one thing being said. And I think the way they dealt with that, the way the new team dealt with that, was simply to take stuff out. That anything that people would say, I'm uncomfortable with this section, and they would, instead of dealing with it, they would just remove it. To me, that kind of dumbed the series down. I don't think it made people think or move to new places in their head.
So how does this, your relationship here at recent experience at PBS, compare with previously with the news that you produced? Has it always been this way?
When America is in a crisis, we become consensus oriented, and we get very nervous, I think, by people who step outside. But the problem is that in order to solve our problems, we have to step outside. I mean, that when Ted said to me, "Keep it international, international, international," what he meant was, I believe, is you've got to look at this issue from an international perspective, not just from an American perspective. Well, as we know, as we ought to know anyway, the rest of the world views a lot of these issues very differently than the United States. We made that completely clear. We talked to many, many international people who were told us, you know, this, you guys are seeing this wrong. It should be looked at in a different way. A lot of that was removed, I think, because Americans just didn't want, well, at least the perception was, Americans didn't want to hear that right now. You know, we're in a crisis. And when you know, I mean, Dixie Chicks, we know the number, Tim Robbins, we know the number of people who have really fairly mildly criticized the administration policy, I mean, compared to the demonstrations in the 60s, mild, and yet have suffered fairly severe consequences as a result of that. You know, it won't play their music. And I went in to buy a bottle of French vodka the other day in my liquor store, and Grey Goose, and he said, "Do you know this is French?" Well, I mean, my goodness. And then the Congress gets together and they change the name of the French fries to Freedom Fries? I mean, this is not a context in which people really want to hear a lot of different opinions.
So, again, from your perspective of many years in the industry, how do we as citizens begin to shape this back into a more palatable form?
Boy, that's a tough one. I think that, you know, the Internet, of course, is a mixed blessing because, you know, there's a lot of information out there and a lot of it's wrong. And that's a problem. But I do think that we really have to work very hard as citizens of America to tie in with the viewpoints of others and figure out how other people see. Why do people in the world? I mean, when I was young, America was a symbol of freedom and an inspiration for people around the world. You know, everybody, I mean, this was, Ho Chi Minh based his constitution in communist North Vietnam on the American Constitution. That's how enamored people were with American values and ideals. And now that's gone. That seems to be, in many ways, gone. There's a, you know, we are, I don't think we as people, but I think our government is viewed very critically by people around the world. Well, you can find that if you go to websites, there are international websites, you know, all over. You can go and read this. You can find out what these people are saying. You can, even the BBC, I think, gives a more, in my view anyway, gives the BBC News, gives a more complete picture than perhaps the American media does. But we have to work hard to find these alternative sources, because I don't think mainstream media at this time is going to carry them.
Do you think we as citizens have a chance of shaping our American media?
Well, that's an interesting question. Obviously we do, because it's all driven by trying to sample and survey what we like and don't like. The problem, of course, is that the advertisers are primarily concerned with the 18 to 49-year-old impulse buying male. And so a lot of the program is designed for them, and it's got to be entertaining, and there's a strong tendency to appeal to the lowest common denominator. But good stuff does get out there. I mean, there is good programming on PBS. There's terrific programming on PBS. There's great programming on HBO. HBO documentaries are terrific. Many of the news specials are good. It's just, you've really got to look for them and dig into them, and I think we really have to look for alternative sources, though, to get the more interesting and provocative ideas. The world is in a very kind of crisis time right now. They're very, very dangerous times, and a lot of us feel that dealing with these in the old ways is simply not going to work, because we have a new problem to deal with, and we need new ways to deal with them. And there are a lot of people out there with good ideas, and we need to spread those around.
So you're going to be speaking this morning at Elliott Bay Books.
Yes, I am.
At 10 o'clock?
Yes.
What are some of the things you're going to be covering there?
Well, I think we'll go over this, I think, pretty much. I'd like to have questions, so if I can do this briefly with the folks and ask questions, I'd like to see what's in their mind.
Mm-hmm. And where do you go from here with your career? Was this a big black mark on your resume, or is this actually a badge of honor?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I think probably PBS is not going to be too happy with me for a while, as long as the current folks are in charge, so I don't see much hope there. But a lot of the other people I talk to in cable and broadcasting, my other clients, they're really not even aware that the series, I mean, it's kind of sad, actually, in a way. They weren't even aware that the series was on the air, and I hear things like, oh, weren't you working on some big PBS series? And boy, you know, I mean, Ted put a lot of money into this. Millions of dollars, and it should have had a big impact.
Just a minute left. I had forgotten I wanted to ask you. So did you see like a separation between Ted Turner and his company that you worked with? Were they like two separate entities, both going in somewhat different directions?
I think Ted was distracted. You know, he had a big movie coming out, the Gods and Generals, that was a big thing. He lost a huge amount of money when AOL stock crashed, and he was concerned with that. He was working in the board, and I think in a good sense, he's a delegator, which is probably, I think, a good way to be, actually. I wish some of the people under him had delegated more to me.
All right. Well, with that, we are unfortunately out of time. I'd like to thank you for coming in this morning.
Thanks so much for having me, Mike.
All right. We've just been talking with Christopher Koch, the Emmy Award-winning producer, and was the lead producer on Avoiding Armageddon.